Chapter 70. Harry Hirschfeld stood in the main haulage on 66 level. There was bustle all around him. Already the crews from the cementation company were manhandling their equipment up towards the blocked drive. These were specialists from an independent contracting company. They were about to begin pumping thousands of tons of liquid cement into the rock jam that sealed the drive. They would pump it in at pressures in excess of 3,000 pounds per square inch. And when that concrete set, it would form a plug that would effectively seal off the drive for all time. It would also form a burial vault for the body of Big King, thought Harry. A fitting monument to the man who had saved the Sonder Ditch. He would arrange to have a commemorative plaque placed on the outer wall of the cement plug, with a suitable inscription describing the man and the deed. The man's dependents must be properly taken care of. Perhaps they could be flown down for the unveiling of the plaque. Anyway, he could leave that to public relations and personnel. The haulage stank of wetness and mud. It was dank and clammy cool, and it would not improve his lumbago. Harry had seen enough. He started back towards the shaft. Faintly, he was aware of the muted clangour of the mighty pumps, which in a few days would free the Sonder Ditch of the water that filled her lower levels. The laden stretchers, with their grisly blanket-covered burdens, stood in a row under the hastily rigged electric lights along one wall of the tunnel. Harry's expression hardened as he passed them. "I'll have the guts of the man responsible for this," he vowed silently as he waited for the cage. Terry Steiner rode in the rear of the ambulance with Rod. She wiped the mud from his face. "How bad is it, Dan?" she asked. "Hell, Terry, he'll be up and about in a few days. The arms, of course, are not very pretty. That's why I'm taking him directly to Johannesburg. I want a specialist orthopedic surgeon to set them. Apart from that, he is suffering from shock pretty badly, and his hands are superficially lacerated. But he will be fine." Dan watched curiously as Terry fussed ineffectually with the damp hair of the drugged man. "You want a smoke?" he asked. "Light me one, please, Dan," she said, and he passed her the cigarette. "I didn't know that you and Rod were so friendly," he ventured. Terry looked up at him quickly. "How very delicate you are, Dr. Stander," she mocked him. "None of my business, of course," hurriedly Dan withdrew. "Don't be silly, Dan. You're a good friend of Rod's, and Joy is mine. You two are entitled to know. I am desperately, crazily in love with this big hunk. I intend divorcing Manfred just as soon as possible." "Is Rod going to marry you?" asked Dan. "He hasn't said anything about marriage, but I'll sure as hell start working on him." Terry grinned, and Dan laughed. "Good luck to you both, then. I'm sure Rod will be able to get another job." "What do you mean?" Terry demanded. "They say your grandfather is threatening to fire him so high, he'll be the first man on the moon." Terry relapsed into silence. Proof was what Pops had asked for. But what proof was there? "They'll be waiting on the X-ray reports," Joy Albright gave her opinion. Since her engagement to Dan, Joy had suddenly become something of a medical expert. She had rushed down to the Johannesburg Central Hospital at Dan's hurried telephonic request. Dan wanted her to keep Terry company while she waited for Rod to come out of emergency. They sat together in the waiting room. "I expect so," Terry agreed. Something Joy had just said had jolted in her mind, something she must remember. It takes them 20 minutes or so to expose the plates and develop them. Then the radiologist has to examine the plates and make his report to the surgeon. There. Joy had said it again. Terry sat up straight and concentrated on what Joy had said. Which word had disturbed her? Suddenly she had it. "The report!" she exclaimed. "That's it! The report! That's the proof!" She leapt out of her chair. "Joy, give me the keys of your car," she demanded. "What on earth?" Joy looked startled. "I can't explain now. I have to get home to Sandown urgently. Give me your keys. I'll explain later." Joy fished in her handbag and produced a leather key folder. Terry snatched it from her. "Where are you parked?" Terry demanded. "In the car park near the main gate." "Thanks, Joy." And Terry dashed from the waiting room. Her high heels clattered down the passage. "Crazy woman." Joy looked after her, bewildered. 10 minutes later, Dan looked into the waiting room. "Oh, Rod's fine now. Where's Terry?" "She went mad," and Joy explained her abrupt departure. Dan looked grave. "I think we'd better follow her, Joy." "I think you're right, darling." "I'll just grab my coat," said Dan. There was only one place where Manfred would keep the geological report on the Big Dipper that Rod had told her about. That was in the safe deposit behind the panelling in his study. Because her jewellery was kept in the same safe, Terry had a key and the combination to the lock. Even in Joy's Alfa Romeo, taking liberties with the traffic regulations, it was a 35-minute drive out to Sandown. It was after 5 in the evening when Terry coasted down the long driveway and parked before the garages. The extensive grounds were deserted, for the gardeners finished at 5 and there was no sign of life from the house. This was as it should be, for she knew Manfred was still in Europe. He was not due back for at least another 4 days. Leaving the ignition keys in the Alfa, Terry ran up the pathway and onto the stoop. She fumbled in her handbag and found the keys to the front door. She let herself in and went directly to Manfred's study. She slid the concealing panel aside and set about the lengthy business of opening the steel safe. It required both key and combination to activate the mechanism, and Terry had never developed much expertise at tumbling the combination. Finally, however, the door swung open, and she was confronted by the voluminous contents. Terry began removing the various documents and files, examining each one, and then stacking them neatly on the floor beside her. She had no idea of the shape, size, nor colour of the report for which she was searching. It was 10 minutes before she selected an unmarked folder and flicked open the cover. "Confidential report on the geological formations of the Kitchenerville gold fields, with special reference to those areas lying to the east of the Big Dipper Dyke." Terry felt a wonderful lift of relief as she read the titling, for she had begun doubting that the report was here. Quickly, she thumbed through the pages and began reading at random. There was no doubt. "This is it," she exclaimed aloud. "I'll take that, thank you." The dreaded, familiar voice cut into her preoccupation, and Terry spun around and came to her feet in one movement, clutching the file protectively to her breast. She backed away from the man who stood in the doorway. She hardly recognized her own husband. She had never seen him like this. Manfred was coatless, and his shirt was without collar or stud. He appeared to have slept in his trousers, for they were rumpled and baggy. There was a yellow stain down the front of his white shirt. His scanty brown hair was dishevelled, hanging forward wistfully onto his forehead. He had not shaved, and the skin around his eyes was discoloured and puffy. "Give that to me!" He came towards her with hand outstretched. "Manfred!" She kept moving away from him. "What are you doing here? When did you get back?"
"Give it to me, you slut!"
"Why do you call me that?" she asked, trying for time.
"Slut!"
he repeated and lunged towards her. Terry whirled away from him lightly. She ran for the study door with Manfred close behind her. She beat him into the passage and raced for the front door. Her heel caught in one of the Persian carpets that covered the floor of the passage, and she staggered and fell against the wall.
"Whore!"
He was on her instantly, trying to wrestle the report out of her hands, but she clung to it with all her strength. Face to face, they were almost of a height, and she saw the madness in his eyes. Suddenly, Manfred released her. He stepped back, bunched his fist, and swung it round-armed into her cheek. Her head jerked back and cracked against the wall. He threw back his fist and hit her again. She felt the quick, warm burst of blood spurt from her nose and staggered through the door beside her into the dining room. She was dizzy from the blows, and she fell against the heavy, stinkwood table. Manfred was close behind her. He charged her, sending her sprawling backwards onto the table. He was on top of her, both his hands at her throat.
"I'm going to kill you, you whore!"
he wheezed. His thumbs hooked and pressed deep into the flesh of her throat. With a frenzied strength of despair, Terry clawed at his eyes with both hands. Her nails scored his face, raking long red lines into his flesh. With a cry, Manfred released her and backed away, holding both hands to his injured face, leaving Terry lying gasping across the table. He stood for a moment, then uncovered his face and inspected the blood on his hands.
"I'll kill you for that!"
But as he advanced towards her, Terry rolled over the table.
"Whore! Slut! Bitch!"
he screamed at her, following her around the table, but Terry kept ahead of him. There were a matched pair of heavy Stuart crystal decanters on the sideboard, one containing port, the other sherry. Terry snatched up one of them and turned to face Manfred. She hurled the decanter with all her remaining strength at his head. Manfred did not have time to duck. The decanter cracked against his forehead, and he fell backwards, stunned. Terry snatched up the report and ran out of the dining room, down the passage, out of the front door, and into the garden. She was running weakly, following the driveway towards the main road. Then, behind her, she heard the engine of an automobile roar into life. Panting wildly, holding the report, she stopped and looked back. Manfred had followed her out of the house. He was behind the steering wheel of Joy's Alfa Romeo. As she watched, he threw the car into gear and howled towards her, blue smoke burning from the rear tires with the speed of the acceleration. His face behind the windscreen was white and streaked with the marks of her nails. His eyes were staring insane, and she knew he was going to ride her down. She kicked off her shoes and ran off the driveway onto the lawns. Crouched forward in the driver's seat of the Alfa, Manfred watched the fleeing figure ahead of him. Terry ran with the full-hipped sway of the mature woman. Her long legs were tanned, and her hair flew out loosely behind her. Manfred was not concerned with the return of the geological report. Its existence was no longer of significance to him. What he wanted was to completely destroy this woman. In his crazed state, she had become the symbol and the figurehead of all his woes. His humiliation and fall were all linked to her. He could exact his vengeance by destroying her, crushing that revolting, warm and clinging body, bruising it, ripping it with the steel of the Alfa Romeo chassis. He hit second gear and spun the steering wheel. The Alfa swerved from the driveway, and as its rear wheels left the tarmac, they skidded on the thick grass. Deftly, Manfred checked the skid and lined up on Terry's running back. Already, she was among the protea bushes on the lower terrace. The Alfa buck-jumped the slope, flying bird-free before crashing down heavily on its suspension. Wheels spun and bit, and the sleek vehicle shot forward again. Terry looked back over her shoulder. Her face was white, and her eyes very big and fear-filled. Manfred giggled. He was aware of a sense of power, the ability to dispense life or death. He steered for her, reckless of all consequences, intent on destroying her. There was a 6-foot-tall protea bush ahead of him, and Manfred roared through it, bursting it asunder. Scattering branches and leaves, giggling again, he saw Terry directly ahead of him. She was still looking back at him, and at that moment she stumbled and fell onto her knees. She was helpless, her face streaked with tears and blood, her hair falling forward in wild disorder, kneeling as though for the headsman's stroke. Manfred felt a flood of disappointment. He did not want it to end so soon. He wanted to savour this sadistic elation, this sense of power. At the last possible moment, he yanked the wheel over and the car slewed violently. It shot past Terry with 6 inches to spare, and its rear wheels pelted her with clods of turf and thrown dirt. Laughing aloud, wild-eyed, Manfred held the wheel hard over, bringing the Alfa around in a tight skidding circle, crackling sideways through another protea bush. Terry was up and running again. He saw immediately that she was heading for the change rooms of the swimming pool, among the trees on the bottom lawn, and she was far enough ahead to elude him, perhaps. "Bitch!" he snarled, and crash-changed into third gear, with engine revs peaking. The Alfa howled in pursuit of the running girl. Had Terry thrown the bulky report aside, she might have reached the brick change rooms ahead of the racing sports car. But the report hampered and slowed her. She still had 20 yards to cover. She was running along the paved edge of the swimming pool, and she sensed that the car was right on top of her. Terry dived sideways, hitting the water flat on her side, and the Alfa roared past. Manfred trod heavily on the brakes, and the Michelin metallic tires screeched against the paving stones, and Manfred was out of the driver's seat the moment the Alfa stopped. Manfred ran back to the pool side. Terry was floundering towards the far steps. She was exhausted, weak with exertion and terror. Her sodden hair streamed down over her face, and she was gasping, open-mouthed for air. Manfred laughed again, a high-pitched, almost girlish giggle, and he dived after her, landing squarely between Terry's shoulder blades with his full weight. She went under, sucking water agonizingly into already aching lungs, and when she surfaced, she was coughing and gagging, blinded with water and her own wet hair. Almost immediately, she felt herself seized from behind and forced face down into the water. For half a minute, she struggled fiercely, and then her movements slowed and became weaker. Manfred stood over her, chest deep in the clear water, gripping her around the waist and by a handful of her sodden hair, forcing her face deep below the surface. He had lost his spectacles, and he blinked owlishly. The wet silk of his shirt clung to his upper body, and the water had slicked his hair down. As he felt the life going out of her, and her movements becoming sluggish and slow, he began to laugh again. The broken, incoherent laughter of a madman. Dan! Joy pointed off through the trees. That's my car down there, parked by the swimming pool. What the hell is it doing there? There's something wrong. Terry wouldn't drive through her beloved garden unless there was. Dan braked sharply and pulled his Jaguar to the side of the driveway. I'm going to take a look. He slid out of the car and started off across the lawns. Joy opened her own door and trotted after him. Dan saw the man in the water, fully dressed, intent on what he was doing. He recognized Manfred Steiner. What the hell is he up to? Dan started running. He reached the edge of the pool, and suddenly he realized what was happening. Christ, he's drowning her! He shouted aloud, and he sprang into the water. He did not waste time struggling with Manfred. He hit him a great open-handed, round-armed blow that cracked against the side of Manfred's head like a pistol shot, and sent him lurching sideways, releasing his grip on Terry. Ignoring Manfred, Dan picked Terry from the water like a drowned kitten and waded to the steps. He carried her out and laid her face down on the paving. He knelt over her and began applying artificial respiration. He felt Terry stir under his hands, then cough and retch weakly. Joy came up at the run and dropped on her knees beside him. My God, Dan, what has happened? That little bastard was trying to drown her. Dan looked up from his labours without interrupting the rhythm of his movement over Terry. She spluttered and retched again. On the far side of the pool, Manfred Steiner had dragged himself from the pool. He was sitting on the edge, with his feet still dangling into the water. His head was hanging, and he was fingering the side of his face where Dan had hit him. On his lap, he held a wet, pulpy mess that had been the geological report. Joy, can you take over here? Terry's not too far gone, and I want to get my hands on that little Hun. Joy took Dan's place over Terry's prostrate form, and Dan stood up. What are you going to do to him? Joy asked. I'm going to beat him to a pulp. Good show, Joy encouraged him. Give him one for me. Manfred had heard the exchange, and as Dan ran around the edge of the pool, he scrambled to his feet and staggered to the parked Alpha. He slammed the door and whirred the engine to life. Dan was just too late to stop him. The car shot forward across the lawns, leaving Dan running, futile, behind it. "Look after her, Joy!" Dan shouted back. By the time Dan had run up the terrace to his Jaguar and reversed it to point in the opposite direction, the Alpha had disappeared through the white gates with a musical flutter of its exhaust. Come on, girlie, Dan spoke to his Jaguar. Let's go get him. The rear wheels spun as he pulled away. Without his spectacles, Manfred Steiner's vision was blurred and milky. The outlines of all objects on which he looked were softened and indistinct. He instinctively checked the Alpha at the stop street at the bottom of the lane. He sat undecided, water still streaming from his clothing, squelching in his shoes. Beside him, on the passenger seat, lay the sodden report, its pages beginning to disintegrate from its soaking and the rough handling it had received. He had to get rid of it. It was the shred of incriminating evidence. That was the only clear thought Manfred had. For the first time in his life, the crystalline clarity of his thought processes was interrupted. He was confused, his mind jerking abruptly from one subject to another. The intense pleasure of inflicting hurt on Terry mingled with the sting and smart of his own injuries. He could not concentrate on either sensation, for overlying it all was a sense of fear, of uncertainty. He felt vulnerable, hunted, hurt, and shaken. His brain flickered and wavered, as though a computer had developed an electrical fault. The answers it produced were nonsensical. He looked in the rearview mirror, saw the Jaguar glide out between the white gates, and turn towards him. "Christ!" he panicked. He rammed his foot down on the accelerator and engaged the clutch. The Alpha screeched out into the main highway, swerved into the path of a heavy truck, bounced over the far curb, and swung back into the road. Dan watched it tear away towards Kyalami. He let the truck pass and then swung into the traffic behind it. He had to wait until the road was clear ahead before he could overtake the truck, and by that time the Alpha was a dwindling cream speck ahead of him. Dan settled back in the leather bucket seat and gave the Jaguar its head. He was furious, outraged by the treatment he had seen Manfred meting out to Terry. Her swollen and bruised face had shocked him, and his feet were firmly set upon the path of vengeance. His hands gripped the steering wheel fiercely. He was muttering threats of violence as the speedometer moved up over the 100-mile-per-hour mark, and he began relentlessly overhauling the cream sports car. Steadily he moved up behind the Alpha until he was driving almost on its rear bumper. The Alpha was held up by a green school bus. Dan could not pass, however, for there was a steady stream of traffic coming in the opposite direction. He fastened his attention on the back of Manfred's head, still fuming with anger. Dan dropped down a gear, ready to pull out and overtake the Alpha when the opportunity arose. At that moment, Manfred looked into his rear-view mirror. Dan saw the reflection of his white face with disordered damp hair hanging onto the forehead, saw his expression change immediately he recognized Dan, and the Alpha shot out into the face of the approaching traffic. There was the howl and blare of horns. Vehicles swerved to make way for Manfred's wild rush. Dan glimpsed frightened faces flicking past, but the Alpha had squeezed around the green bus and was speeding away. Dan dropped back, then sent the Jaguar like a thrown javelin through the gap between bus and curb, overtaking on the wrong side and ignoring the bus driver's yell of protest. The Jaguar had a higher top speed, and on the long, straight Pretoria Highway, Dan crept up steadily on the cream Alpha. He could see Manfred glancing repeatedly into his driving mirror, and he grinned mirthlessly. Ahead of them, the highway rose and then dipped over a low, rounded ridge. A double avenue of tall blue gum trees flanked each side of the road. Travelling in the same direction as the two high-performance sports cars was a Mini of a good vintage year. Its elderly driver was triumphantly about to overtake an overloaded vegetable truck. Neck and neck they approached the blind rise at 25 miles per hour, between them effectively blocking half the road. The horn of the Alpha wailed a high-pitched warning, and Manfred pulled out to overtake both slower vehicles. He was level with them, well out over the white dividing line, when a cement truck popped up over the blind rise. Dan stood on his brake pedal with all the strength of his right leg and watched it happen. The cement truck and the Alpha came head-on towards each other at a combined speed of well over 100 miles an hour. At the last moment, the Alpha began to turn away, but it was too late by many seconds. It caught the heavy cement truck a glancing blow and was hurled across the path of the two slower vehicles, miraculously touching neither of them. It skidded sideways, leaving reeking black smears of rubber on the tarmac, and hurled the low bank. It struck one of the blue gums full on, with a force that shivered the giant tree trunk and brought down a rain of leaves. Dan pulled the Jaguar into the side of the road, parked it, and walked back. He knew there was no hurry. The drivers of the Mini and the vegetable truck were there before him. They were attempting to talk each other down, both of them excited and relieved by their own escapes. "I'm a doctor," said Dan, and they fell back respectfully. "He doesn't need a doctor," said one of them. "He needs an undertaker." One look was sufficient. Dr. Manfred Steiner was as dead as Dan had ever seen anybody. His crushed head was thrust through the windscreen. Dan picked up the sodden bundle of paper from the seat beside the huddled body. He was aware that some particular importance was attached to it. Dan's anger had evaporated entirely, and he felt a twinge of pity as he looked into the wreckage at the corpse. It appeared so frail and small, of such little consequence.